Morning.
I really like that. So I just said if there were gaps, you just squeeze up the gaps and that. And that's happened around most places, except no one squeezed the gap up to here towards me, but that's okay, I guess. I just thought, you know, someone might have squeezed these gaps up this way. You know, we all did the sideways thing good, but no one came closer to me, so I'm feeling a bit left out, but that's all right. Well, no, I just thought, you know, we could have. It doesn't matter. Hey, going to think today about what's important. Like, we're in the book of Mark and we're looking at Jesus, and he's a really good place to start with figuring out what's important, because he's pretty important, as we're going to even hear more about today. But, excuse me, I'm just going on Facebook just a sec. Because not because I'm going on Facebook, I just had to read you something off Facebook. Just to clarify. So, on my Facebook, I think you call it, I don't know if it's called status or profile, the bit at the top anyway that says who you are. This is my my profile statusy thing. It says love life, love Lorraine, my boys and Jesus, love Hamilton, love to run, ice cream, flat whites and oranges. Specifically, ice cream should say vanilla because that's the flavour I like most, which annoys my family heaps. Yeah, it is. And you go to some flash places and then they don't have vanilla. It's like, what the heck? Like, unbelievable. It sort of tells you about what's important, eh, you know? So, but what would you do? I mean, you might not be a Facebooker, you might be or whatever, but if you had to suddenly, succinctly, within a few words, you know, define yourself, in a way at that point, we actually say, what's important? What's important? There's another way to put it. We wouldn't like to put it this, but what do we think is greatest is really what we're saying. What's the greatest? Who's the greatest in my life, and what is the greatest in my life? Who would that be for you? What would that be for you? What would be really important? I like that as we're journeying the story of Jesus through the book of Mark, it's as if at the beginning it's got this really real clarity around who Jesus is, and then it kind of is almost as if it's like this blurry image that's gradually coming into full focus about who Jesus is and what's important to him and therefore should be important to us. There's a real shift that goes on. I mean, you start off with Mark 1 and 1, and it gives us this clarity around the person of Jesus. It says the beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. So there's this great clarity, and yet the first eight chapters, the first half of the book, is almost as if there's this blurriness about the identity of Jesus, that those who follow him, specifically his disciples, are sort of looking at him, squinting, trying to figure out who he is, and gradually he comes into sharp focus. That can even be true in our experience as we come to know Jesus. You know, that in some ways he can be like this mythical character, and maybe we come to a point where we suddenly realise that he's actually historical, and then there's this huge leap to realising that he's current and real, like as in he's not just a historical figure, but he's present and alive. And then what does that mean in our lives? Is he still just this historical figure who's kind of technically real and alive today that we listen to his historical words, or can we engage in life with him? And so for the disciples, they're going through this process, and I don't know if you remember back, but at family camp, we were exploring the time when he's saying to his followers, who do people think I am? You know, what's the clarity out there about who I am? And there's not much, really. And then he says, who do you think? And Peter voices up and says, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Peter affirms what Mark wrote at the beginning. See, so Mark's going, here's the clarity, this is who he is, and it takes half the book to actually, for anyone else to catch up to that. And it's as if like the rest of the book starts to tell us what that means in reality. What does it truly mean for Jesus to be Messiah? I mean, we talked at camp about these three ideas, that Messiah means the anointed one, one who is specifically chosen. And in the Old Testament, that would normally be attributed to someone royal, like a king appointed for a role, or to a priest appointed to lead the people in worship. It could also be somebody could be considered to be an appointed one or anointed one who is a prophet. And we also looked at the fact that Jesus came uniquely as the Son of God, God in human flesh. So Jesus was Messiah as he was king, prophet, priest, Son of God. And this is starting to become clear to the disciples, but still not yet. And then I really enjoyed, I was just listening to the podcast this last week, Dave's message from two Sundays ago. And if you haven't heard that, go on to Podbean, City Bible Church. Look that one up. At, I can't remember what it's called, but the date would have been 2 weeks ago anyway. Is looking at, as Jesus starts to reveal who he is, he just says some outlandishly radical things that were so different to the thought of the day or the thought of our day. And these were just four that I thought of that sort of come out of that. The first one is death precedes life. You know, it's back to front than how we see life, isn't it? Like, life precedes death. Like, life, the only certainty with that is death, isn't it? And yet, here Jesus says, actually, death precedes life. He says the last will be first. And that's just weird. I mean, my kids hate my driving because they say I'm always taking the slow lane, whether it's the fast lane or the slow lane. I'm choosing the wrong lane, you know, when I'm at the motorway. Or if I'm at the supermarket, I always choose the wrong checkout because I'm always in the one that ends up last. They say that you choose the wrong one and you are last. You last because you're last, you know. And what's the idea there? The idea is that we want to be in the fast lane. We want to be in the fast checkout. We want to be first in queue. We don't want to be last. Jesus goes, actually, the last is going to be first. Loss means gain. To lose means to gain. It doesn't make sense. And then the servant is the one who is great. And it's interesting as we come into these chapters today, Mark 11 and 12, and we think about what's important, is Jesus is going to come into an interaction with the authorities of the day in Jerusalem, the authorities, the people that matter and their voice counts in Israel. And it's going to be like a head-to-head with them about what matters. And we're going to see what matters for them is their position of authority, is their power, is Jerusalem, is the temple courts, is all that goes on there. Their whole identity is wrapped up in that. And Jesus is going to challenge that. And so if you want to have a look in your Bible, we're just going to start just back one chapter, 10, verse 42, Mark 10, 42, because this is kind of like the bridge into this interaction that's going to happen in Jerusalem. As Jesus continues to teach his disciples about what it means for him to be the Messiah and the Son of God, as he begins to head towards Jerusalem, where we know he's going to eventually die on a cross. And as he's teaching them these things that seem upside down to what they know in life, he sort of caps it off with this one, verse 42. Jesus called them together, this is his disciples, and he said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their officials exercise authority over them." This is like he's saying, this is the way it is, you know, in life, is people want to be the boss. Verse 43, "Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." So once again, here's Jesus' talk. This is his theory. His theory is that, you know, last will be first. Loss means gain. Servant is great. But then he says this, and this is the beginning, if you like, of Jesus walking the talk. Of Jesus not just speaking theory, but living into reality. And he says this, "And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." Verse 45, "For even the Son of Man," that's a title he gives to himself, "did not come to be served." So even the Son of God, the Almighty One, the Creator of the universe, didn't come to be served, but to serve. "And to give his life a ransom for many." Jesus is saying, I've come to be the servant, not to be first, but to be last. And the greatness will be in my serving. And as I serve, I want to tell you that I'm going to give up my life. I'm going to die. And then he heads towards Jerusalem. So here's our text for the day. Chapter 11, verse 1. As they approach Jerusalem. Okay, so we know where they are. They're on their way into Jerusalem, the capital city of Israel, the location of the temple, known as the City of David, the famous King David, their most famous king. And it's interesting that the language we're going to bump into is that over these next 3 days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, which is interesting, we're going to start celebrating that like next Sunday is the Sunday we're talking about, Palm Sunday. And so what we're reading about here is part of our, you know, remembrance, if you like, that we're going to begin next Sunday in the week that leads to Easter. But we're going to find Jesus going into Jerusalem, going into the temple courts where the people could gather, and coming out of Jerusalem, and then going into Jerusalem. You're going to see him coming in and out of Jerusalem. You're going to see him coming in and out of the temple courts. You're going to see him coming in and out of interaction with the people. And as he does so, we're going to be witnesses and listen in on a debate that's happening between him and the authorities of the day, between him and those that lead the people. So let's read it again. So verse 1, as they approached Jerusalem, came to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples, and he sent them into the city, and they were to get a colt, the young colt of a donkey, and bring it on out for him to ride. And as he hops on this donkey and he rides into the city, the people cry out these words, Hosanna, verse 3, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest heaven. So basically it's like this big sort of Santa parade, if you like, or a big Mulu win the Ranfurly Shield parade, although a lot of young ones don't know what that is anymore, not because we never win it, but because it's not popular. But it's a street parade. But it's all around Jesus, and what's interesting is there's a clarity there. Though they don't understand the implication, the clarity is this, is that this one coming in on a donkey is the coming king that was promised, the son of our great King David, who will reign in Jerusalem forever. And what they were thinking currently of the day is he's going to overcome Roman oppression and rule, and he's going to allow us to be free again. And so there's this great excitement, and they're throwing their robes and garments down on the road, and they're taking palm branches, which is why it's called Palm Sunday, and they're putting those down on the ground for Jesus to ride this donkey in. And then verse 11 says this, Jesus entered Jerusalem and went into the temple courts. And we're going to find he does that every day. He goes into the place where the people could come to worship. It's not the real inner part where just the priests go, but the temple courts. Some say that this is possibly the outer temple courts where even the Gentiles could go, the non-Jews. And some say it could be what they call the court of the woman. That doesn't mean it's woman only, but it means that the women were allowed in that court, and then there's another court. But it seems to me as Jesus enters this public place, he enters a place where the people are, but also enters a place where the leadership are and where the debate is going to begin. But I want you to notice the first time he enters in, he enters as king. He enters as king. There's question in some of the other gospels by the authorities as to whether he is king, and they try to shut the people down. But the general crowd are going, yeah, this is the king. So there's some recognition, some clarity. Jesus comes as Messiah, anointed king. And then he leaves again. He departs again. Then we come to chapter 11, verse 15. This is Monday now. And Jesus is now going to enter more like in a priestly, prophetic kind of way. Verse 15, on reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts. And he began to drive out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it a den of robbers. Some would say there was a real abuse going on here of the non-Jew within this part of the temple courts. So that's where some would say this is the court of the Gentiles. They're saying that the marketplace was sort of on that most outside court where local Jews could rip off proselytes who are coming on in to do their worship. We don't know if that's exactly true, but it could be one of the reasons. But it's almost as if as Jesus comes into this place where the widest group of people are welcome, even though they might be discriminated against, Jesus says, even this place should be holy. Even this place should be dedicated to prayer and not a place of commerce. And so he cleans the place out. It's interesting, verse 18, the chief priests and teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him. Isn't it weird? So get this, the chief priests and teachers of the law, they're the guys who love God and are about prayer and the temple and holiness, and they're anti this guy because he just cleaned corruption out of their temple. Do you get this? So it tells us something's wrong, that the leadership is corrupt. and that the leadership has other agendas other than a love of God. So they were looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. So that's Monday. Tuesday arrives, verse 27. And now Jesus is going to enter Jerusalem again. And this time, really, what's going to raise up is as he's come in and the people have proclaimed him as king, then he's sort of come in almost like self-proclaimed priest-prophet, bringing truth and clearing the temple courts. This time he comes in and the authorities are going to question his authority, because I think they suddenly realize who he's really claiming to be, that as Jesus enters Jerusalem on the Tuesday, they're going, this guy thinks he's God, because they're starting to ask about the authority with which he speaks. And so the Son of God enters Jerusalem. Verse 27, they arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders came to him. By what authority are you doing these things, they asked, and who gave you the authority to do this? And so this is the beginning of the debate between the authorities of the day and the authority of Jesus. Who is king? Who ultimately is the chief priest? Who is the one that has the direct word from God? Who is the authority? I find it interesting that as they enter into this debate, you know, and there's chief priests, teachers of the law, elders, Pharisees, Herodians, Sadducees, it's kind of like, it's like the temple court is kind of like being at the beehive, maybe on the steps of the beehive, I don't know. But, you know, and who's there, you know? Labor's there, the Greens are there, Firsts are there, you know, Nationals there, ACT's there, they're all there. And there's probably other voices there too, you know, like Family First are probably there and different groups are there. You know, they're there because they're the voice. They're the watchdogs. They're the ones who their opinion matters. And as they're there, they begin this debate with Jesus. It's almost like all of them versus Jesus. And they have some questions for him. And the first question is about his authority. And I love Jesus' answer. As you go through this chapter, that what you'll see is that as Jesus answers them, I just think he's really clever. Like, he's pretty smart because he's Jesus. But sometimes he answers them with a question. Sometimes he answers them directly. This first one over the authority is interesting because he doesn't actually answer their question. He answers their question with a question. And in chapter 11, verse 29, he says, "Oh, I will ask you a question. Answer me and I'll tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? Tell me." It's such an interesting one because then they say, "Wow, so if we say, you know, it's of God, then he'll say, well, why didn't you listen to him? And if we say it's not of God, then the people are going to be really mad at us because they reckon he was." And so that it's interesting that in their authority, suddenly we see what their authority is like. Their authority is based on the opinions of people. Isn't that interesting? Like you look at Jesus' authority. Jesus is not at all worried what people think. He's deeply concerned about how people feel. But as far as what their opinion of him goes or of what he says, he is like a supreme authority because he can just say the truth because he is about the truth, for he is the truth. And these authorities of the day, they can't. They can't actually say what they authoritatively think because they fear what people think. Isn't that interesting? That's like us, isn't it, sometimes? We have authority over some things, and those that have authority over us have some authority, and then don't we notice that all of us, we don't just need to point the finger down to Wellington, like all of us, we squirm and we shift our views and we measure our words because whatever authority we have, we sort of let that be subject often to what we think people's response will be. And that's what was going on here. The authority is not strong. And Jesus is going, you are questioning my authority. You don't even have an authority. Your authority is based on what you think the people will say and whether they'll keep you as their leaders or not. And so they just live out of that fear. The next thing that's raised is Roman taxes. And And so they come to question Jesus again. You just see them, they're sort of like coming up with their next best question. What are we going to say to Jesus on this Tuesday of debate? And so they send, you know, the next group goes in with their question. And so they're saying, hey, look, like, what should happen? Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? You know, well, that's a good question. Like, if you want to create a point of tension within Jerusalem and the people of Israel, it would be taxes. Who wants to pay taxes to the foreign oppressor? Nobody. And so we'll put Jesus on the spot and we'll say that. And so if Jesus says, no, you shouldn't, then we can dob him into the Romans and they'll deal with it. And if he says, yes, we should, then the people are going to turn against him. Do you see again what the local authorities are doing? The local authorities are puppets to Rome. They're not standing on the authority that they would have. They're actually going, oh, we're quite happy to go either way on this. Whatever works best for our elevation, for our promotion, for our position. And in fact, it'll actually work really well for us. If Jesus says you should not pay taxes to Rome, we won't actually get alongside him and say, go Jesus, you revolutionary. We don't want to pay taxes either. We'll actually go over to the Romans and say, hey, this guy here is speaking against you, and that'll deal with him. It's interesting that that Jesus' answer is pretty good, because he's pretty good with those kind of answers. And he basically says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. It's like he elevates their question to another level and just going, you just need to do what you're responsible to do. You're asking me a question to try and trap me. I'm just saying, well, what should you do? Who's the authority right now about that issue? And the authority at that point on that issue was Rome. And it's like, so you look at the coin and Jesus says, you know, whose insignia is on that? And it's like, oh, that's Caesar's. Well, just give Caesar what's Caesar's. It looks like he owns that. Looks like he owns the coins right now and the currency, so I guess he gets to call that. But hey, if you see something and you go, that's God's, then you honor God with that. In a way, he's really doing this. He's not saying Caesar or God. He's going, it's all God, so honor God in everything you do. And by the way, under God's sovereign rule, if there's another area of authority, then actually you should respect that. There's a lesson there, isn't there? And we have that further on in the New Testament. We all want to buck against the authorities when it suits us. But what we sometimes forget is that to obey the supreme authority, God, would be to respect the authorities that are in place. And Jesus is saying, you need to do that. Doesn't mean you can't have an opinion. Doesn't mean you can't have a vote. But it does mean that we show respect and we show submission to those that God has placed an authority over us. And Jesus is really clear with that. That's not the point we're getting at here. That's just a freebie on the side. Next thing, get down to verse 28. Around there is there's this group called the Sadducees who don't believe in the afterlife. And so they come with their question out of Jesus about, you know, this person who dies and then gets remarried and dies and gets remarried and dies and gets remarried. And then who do they end up married to when they get to heaven? It's like, it's a good tricky question. And so we can start trying to figure it out. Maybe they just have, you know, multiple spouses in heaven, or I don't know how that works, you know. Jesus is really interesting with this one in that he once again goes, you're asking me a question about some fine detail, whereas what you don't get is the bigger idea. And in his case, he's actually pointing to the Sadducees going, I know that you guys are asking this because you don't even believe in the afterlife. Isn't it interesting, the question? Like, if you're a Sadducee, is this a valid question of Jesus? Think about it. If you don't believe in the afterlife, why would you ask Jesus, who are you married to in the afterlife? You would only ask him because you're trying to say, man, that's too complicated, so therefore there mustn't be an afterlife, which is sort of like illogical anyway as a point of reasoning. So here he is, and Jesus is going, you guys are asking that question, whereas you don't even believe in the afterlife, so therefore his answer is not about marriage. His answer is about afterlife. And it's really interesting where he goes to, where he talks about that time when God reveals himself to Moses and identifies himself as the I am. I am the one who exists, and I am the one, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Now, at the time when Jesus said that, where was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? So at the time of Moses, where was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Anyone know? Where were they? They were dead. Got that? So God's saying, I am the God of these three dead guys. What does Jesus say about that? Jesus says, when God said that, he's not saying, I am the God of three dead guys. He's saying, I am the God of the living. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, alive with God. God is the God of the living. He's saying, that's proof that there's eternal life. There's an afterlife. There's a life to be had with God. You guys are worried about who's going to be married there. That's because you don't even believe it exists. You need to actually start to think about who your God is. He is a God of the living. And then there comes this last question in the series of questions. This is one I want to focus. Look at chapter 12. And actually, I'll just pull this one up. I think it's verse 30. Verse 28. And so as all this debate's going on, there's these questions and answers and there's this arguments in the temple courts about where does authority sit, who has authority. I like where it finishes. Verse 28. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked them. Now this is different. The tone changes here. So up till now, all the questions are coming at Jesus as conspired trick questions, trying to trap him. They're all just a con, okay? They're trying to put Jesus down to discredit Jesus. I want you to notice that when the fourth question comes in, that this question is different. This teacher has been listening in on the debate, listening in on the questions. And this teacher notices that Jesus gives good answers. So this teacher does not come asking Jesus a trick question. Out of all the four questions, this is the only good question because this guy notices that Jesus gives good answers. I actually believe that this guy wants to know the answer to his question. The other guys don't. This guy's coming not as one with authority, but he's one coming going, wow, this guy answers good answers, questions with good answers. This one has authority. I want to know something from this guy. And it's so different. Sometimes, you know, we might come at God with all our questions like we do sometimes, and then every now and then we more come to him with a slightly different attitude that just really wants to know. So, you know, we can have the, why did this happen? What's going on with that? How does this work? But suddenly we come to him with this genuine, like, maybe it's over a grief or maybe there's a decision we've got to make, and we just come with earnest going, Jesus, if you would just enlighten me in this. And I believe that's the attitude that this guy comes with. He's coming just going, Jesus, I need to know the answer to this. And he's a teacher of the law. He knows all the law. He teaches people the law of Moses. And he says this, of all the commandments, which is the most important? I sort of imagine him like this, a teacher of the law going, Jesus, I'm in the law all the time. I'm in the commands all the time. There's so many of them. And then we've added a whole lot more to them and I'm teaching them all the time. But where should I put my energy and effort? What should be my emphasis? And even personally, man, I wrestle with the law and there's so much to get done and to do right, but where does it really matter, Jesus? And this is Jesus' answer. The most important one, Jesus answered, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. If I think about the questions that Jesus has been getting asked and the answers he's giving, it's kind of like in this cryptic sort of debate. And yet all of a sudden we have just great clarity here where a guy says, what matters most? What is most important in life, Jesus? What's the greatest? And Jesus is really clear. He's going, it's God. And there's a second to God that you need to take special note of, and that's people. And the thing that's most important about God and people is love. Loving them. And you think about all the conversations that have gone on so far, which are about who's in power, who has the authority, who has the position, who's getting listened to. And then who's listening to me and agreeing with me and who's helping me towards my cause. You know, see where it all is? It's all like, it's totally opposite to what Jesus now says is most important. Forget about all that human authority argument going over here and all those things you're trying to figure out. There's one with authority, it's God. And then also all the stuff you're doing with disregard for people, well, actually second to God is your neighbor, the person next to you. And as you're trying to have like control and be first and be great over here, there's something you're missing, and it's called love. This is what's most important. You see the clarity Jesus brings about what is most important in just this whole muddle? And here's where it's really cool. Look at verse 32. Well said, teacher. I kind of like that. I think it means a lot more than that. It's a bit proper, but this guy's teacher of the law, so he's probably got to be proper. But he says, well said, teacher, the man replied, you are right in saying that God is one and there is no other but him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. You've got to catch what this guy's saying, because he's saying a radical thing too. When you think of the context he's in and all the arguments that are going on, he's saying, here we are in the temple courts, and all the authorities are here, and the priests are here, and the sacrifices and offerings are happening, and we're getting everything just right, and we're trying to do everything by the book with disregard for people, and in fact, a disregard for God. And Jesus, you've nailed it. You've actually nailed it, because it is about God and it's about people and it's about loving them. And in fact, that's more important than all the stuff that's going on around here. That supersedes all these debates and these arguments and these power plays. God, people, and love. That's what matters most. And look at Jesus' response to him. When Jesus saw that it answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. It's finally somebody has clarity. Finally somebody sees Jesus for who he is and understands what he's saying about this different world, this kingdom. And it's interesting, it says, and from then on no one dared ask him any more questions. It's like almost like the debate's over, because some guy had the courage to go, what matters most in our law? And Jesus said what did, and they couldn't argue with that, and he affirmed that, and everyone went, case closed. We've lost our points of argument now. Because now it's been given clarity about what is most important. And then, see what's interesting in that? There's no room for corruption in that. There's no room for pride and ego in that. There's no room for that. To love God. To love our neighbor. It's almost as if all the arguments are silenced by love. You could have a look through like the rest of chapter 12. It's pretty interesting there that when we think about what's important, there's some dialogue goes on around King David, you know, the greatest one. And Jesus has explained to him that the son is greater than just a son by birth, that this is son coming who the Lord, David, calls the Lord his son, Lord, you know? One greater than David is here. There's this observation about what's great in the temple and back to things like offerings and what looks like a great offering. And Jesus shows them that even the little old lady giving her last bit of money outshines them all with great giving. And then you finally have the start of chapter 13 where the disciples are still in awe of the temple even after all that's happened. And they're just going, isn't this incredible? And he's just going, see this great thing? It's not even going to last. There's not going to be one stone upon another within a few years. So you see the sense in which Jesus is helping them align what is great. Jesus is greater. A little old lady giving a few coins can be great. And that even the temple and all its greatness is just temporary. But amongst this is where I want to finish. And that's at the start of chapter 12. And I guess next week we're going to look at Jesus really walking the talk, but I think he starts to do that with his words. Because as he tells stories, answers questions, enters debate, sometimes I wonder why he just doesn't get mad with them. Like, isn't that a good option? Like, just to get, like he did with the temple court market, why doesn't he just get mad with the Pharisees and Sadducees and tell them they're idiots and, like, just zap them or something, because he could. Like, But why doesn't he do that? Why doesn't he, like he came in on the donkey and he's got the crowd on his side, why doesn't he just take rule? Like, why doesn't Jesus do that? Why doesn't he do that now? Why doesn't he just take rule of our nation, of our world? Why doesn't he just take, here's more important, why doesn't he just take rule of me right now? Why doesn't he just take rule of you? The stuff that you just wish didn't keep repeating, why doesn't he just take rule of that? Just that out. Like, why won't Jesus, who has all authority, just use his authority and be authoritative and just do it? And yet, somewhere in there, Jesus has a different way. And then as Jesus says, you know, last will be first, greatest are servants, you know, death precedes life. Gain, loss means gain. As he says those things, what we find in him is that that's because he believes those things. Remember, he's the supreme authority. He believes that that's true. He believes that a kingdom that will last forever will be built on that. And so therefore, he lives it out. But before he does, he tells a story. Chapter 12 and verse 1. And we're just going to read it through. I want you to listen to the story. The words will come up on screen if you want to follow. Jesus began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit from the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He still sent another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. See what's going on here? So the guy who has authority, who owns the place, he's let it out, he's rented it out to temporary residents and owners who don't have authority. And as he, the one that has authority, seeks to engage with them, they refuse his authority and they think they have their own authority and they wield it at the expense of people. In their desire to have gain, to own all the wealth for themselves, they devalue the very thing that is most important. Do you see how this is the same story that we've been hearing about? This trying to have authority at the expense of others versus Jesus calling us to love others. But then here's where it twists. Verse 6. This man who had the authority, the man who owned the vineyard, it says he had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. Now, when you and I hear that, we read that, for a lot of us, we go, oh, we know what the story means. You know, we have some insight because we've read the rest of the story. We've read the rest of Mark's story and of the story of Jesus. Verse 9, what then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read this passage of Scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this and it's marvelous in his eyes. And then this is the interesting part. So think about those he's debating with, those who are trying to have authority, those who are conspiring to kill him. Verse 12, then the chief priests, the teachers of the law and the elders looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he'd spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. Do you see how this story that Jesus tells is the story? Like, he's telling the story. He's going, you guys are just temporary here. God has entrusted you with his people. He's entrusted you with the city and with the temple and with sacrifices and offerings. He's entrusted you with the message that there's a Messiah coming. He's entrusted you with all of that. And as he's entrusted you with that, what's the greatest thing he's called you to do? To love God and to love your neighbor. And what are you doing? You're loving yourselves and you're hurting your neighbor. And then as God has sent the prophets to you to try and point you back to loving God and loving your neighbor, what have you done to them? You've beat them, you've thrown them out, you've killed them. And then at the end, God has gone, I've got one left. He's the son I love. His name is Jesus. He is Messiah. He is King. I'm going to send him. And he comes, and the authorities know what they're going to do with him. That's why when they hear the story, they go, that story is against us. What I find fascinating in this is that amidst the debates is that Jesus tells this story. In a way, this is Jesus' response to the argument over authority and over what's most important. In a way, as Jesus tells the story and then has that interaction with that teacher of the law about what's most important, Jesus has already told them in the story what's most important, and he will then, now we will go into next week, he will show them what is most important. And that's that he will say, I will come as my Father wants me to come because I love my Father. And I will come and I will die because I love you. I'll give my life for my neighbor. See, Jesus is going to walk the talk. And instead of arguing more with these guys, he says, you know what, how it's going to play out? You guys are going to win. You're going to conspire against me and you're going to take me and you're going to put me to death. You think you've got authority, you want authority, I want to tell you in the story right now, this is how it's going to play out. The Father has sent me, and I'm here in Jerusalem, and you're going to take me, and you're going to kill me, and you're going to win. But what they didn't realize was what has Jesus already said. Death precedes life. The last will be first. Loss means gain. The servant is the greatest. See what takes place? Jesus comes and he serves us by giving his life for us. And he dies so that he might rise again and that we might have life forever. It's such a different way to see it, and yet it's the way that he calls us to see life. I was trying to think about a way to sum that up, and there's just a couple of lines that might help us think about how this affects you and I today. That in Jesus, I think theory becomes reality. And it's interesting that when you think about our lives and how that I can do so much that's about myself. And Jesus says, this is what it looks like to live for others. One will give their life. And then Jesus says, and I'll show you what that actually is like in reality. And as we'll see next week, he gives his life. Jesus isn't just the talk. He doesn't have a whole lot of great quotes to give, but he actually walks the talk. His theory becomes reality. And Jesus will make history, and we'll be celebrating that in 2 weeks' time. As we celebrate the weirdest thing, we celebrate the grotesque, hideous torture, execution, and murder of God. But we celebrate it historically because it did happen. But we also celebrate it because of this. And he sets in place our eternity because death precedes life. What's most important? Vanilla ice cream, flat whites, oranges, pretty important in my life. Certainly people, my boys and Lorraine. Who's most important? Jesus. Has to be. Does it feel like that every day? No. Do I want it to be? Yeah. And if I come to Jesus and say, Jesus, who do you think is most important and what's most important? He would say, God, people, love, that's it. And then he would finally enter Jerusalem for the last time. And he would be taken by these cruel men and he'd be misjudged and sentenced to death and executed on a Roman cross. because he believes what he says and he walks his talk. And he loves us. And then it's interesting that all those things he said come into play where he says, and you follow me, you do as I have done. You come follow me. You take up your cross. You die to self. All those things. Only because he did them first. So what we want to do right now is we're going to sing and then we're going to take communion. And really, this is a chance for us to respond to Jesus. And this is a thought I just had around our response today. And is as Jesus lays his life down for us, he calls us to respond in the same way. And I think sometimes we jump straight to the, I need to lay my life down for others. Okay, so like Jesus lays his life down for me. He says, you do the same, so I need to lay my life down for you. You for me, etc. But I think before we get there, there's another laying down that has to happen. That as he lays his life down for us, we need to lay our life down to him first. Because sometimes we jump to the, hey, how can I help my neighbor? How can I love others? But it starts with loving him. And so it might be today that we're going to sing, and just during the song, as you sing, these words actually reflect a heart that wants to lay itself down to Jesus. To go, Jesus, you've given all for me. I want to give my life back to you. Simple as that. It's the way in which we can love him. And then at the end of the song, Liam's going to go into a second song. And at that time, I just encourage you to come and take communion. Come and take bread and cup and remember that Jesus gave his body and his blood for you on the cross. As you take the bread and the cup, just thank him for that. And once again, use that as maybe a physical way with words with the song and then physically lay down your life for Jesus. Just begin, Jesus, all that's going on in here and who I am, I just want to give it to you. I just surrender my life for you. I want to be that person that what's most important is God, people, and love. Thank you, Jesus, that you've made that possible. So just encourage you, let's stand just as we sing. And then when the song's finished, I'll pray and I'll call you for communion.